Tonight on Arena, we're in Galway once again with news and reviews from this year's Galway International Arts Festival. @51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And yes, we are in Galway once again this evening, coming to you from the Galway studios. Between now and 8, we'll be speaking to James Shapiro about Shakespeare and Donald Trump, and we'll be reviewing some of the major new productions and exhibitions at this year's Galway International Arts Festival. And let's start with the Irish National Opera production at this year's festival, Least Like the Other. Created by Brian Irvin and Nisha Jones, it traces events in the life of Rosemary, eldest daughter of Joe and Rose Kennedy and sister to JFK. Michael Dungan has been to see the opera and he's with me now in studio. Just the life of Rosemary Kennedy, it's so short, but such a lot happened to her in the space of her 23 years. Who was she, Michael?
Well, it's funny, you know, her conscious life was only 23 years, but she actually lived till 2005, you know, died in her 80s.
Oh, of course, the lobotomy happened at 23.
Exactly, but I mean, you may as well think of her as her life as being over after that. But in those 23 years of her life, you know, she was subjected to an image of how the Kennedy family should be by her father, who was trying to protect the ambitions and the image of his sons in particular and of himself. And she just did not fit in to that picture. She was intellectually disabled.
And when you say she was intellectually disabled, she had somewhat she was born in 1918.
Yes.
Today, what was happening to her in the first 23 years of life, they might be referred to as mild learning difficulties.
They might well be. In the daytime, I'm a teacher, and we see children all the time who don't quite fit in perhaps a standard view of what school life should be for a child or what a student is like. And we look after them as best we can.
They're not expected to conform.
No, and we make a provision and we do our best and we try to bring out what's positive and so on. And, you know, today, Rosemary would have been treated that way.
In the United States of America, in the period we're speaking about, 1941, she was 23 when that lobotomy happened. Yeah. Lobotomy was the great cure for all, and they would have considered them all evils.
Yeah, that's right. There was a moral aspect to it. There was this notion, particularly for women with any kind of intellectual disability, that it would lead to sexual immorality and criminal behavior and so on.
The link between sexual immorality and a woman with mild learning difficulties, that was the reason for the lobotomy.
I suppose so. Also, she had been put into various institutions, and by the time she was 23, and it's no wonder, she began to have violent outbursts and so on. And convulsions as well. And I think they just threw up their hands and said, we no longer know what to do with her.
And when you say they, do you mean Joe and Rose Kennedy?
The family and the institutions where she was. She was more or less removed from sight. She ended up in a school for what was called for the feeble-minded.
Again, a term that, you know, I know it's very easy to look back at 1940s and say, what were they thinking? But it's a term that when you hear it spoken out loud in 2019, it's very, very upsetting, really.
Yeah, it is, yeah. And it is interesting, the mezzo who sings this, she talks about that very thing, what you just said. She says, what will our grandchildren, or some words to the effect of, what will our grandchildren look back on us and say, how could you? You know, and what might it be? How could you eat a ham sandwich?
Yeah, what are we doing today that we don't realize?
How could you drive a car?
Yeah, yeah. Well, they may well be saying that as time goes on, we mightn't be driving cars. But let's get to how it's a subject then, on the surface of it, you would say, this is a subject made for opera. But if you're going to make an opera about this in 2019, you want to be very sensitive to what you're doing as well. You can't just make some big operatic display of a lobotomized person.
Yes, which they could have done. You know, they could have been sensational. You know, sensational things happen in opera all the time. But I think what happened here was that they actually, the composer Brian Irvine And the director, designer and videographer, Nisha Jones, decided they didn't want to emphasise the sensational. They wanted to look at the underlying reasons for what happened and at the themes that surrounded those events that are still obviously relevant today.
So, yeah, because the automatic presumption might be, right, they're going to tell the story of Rosemary Kennedy, so we'll get Rosemary Kennedy was born, then this is what she was like in her early years, she became a teen, and we've been told essentially a biographical story.
Yeah.
But they go about this in a totally different way. Yes, yeah. The biography is told along the way,
yeah.
But we're getting a lot of clinical material, we're getting a lot of archive material. Yeah. What exactly is it that we're being given in words?
Yeah, there's no libretto. I think originally Irvine thought that there ought to be a libretto, but he abandoned that. And I think he was almost obsessive once he heard this story. And he eventually decided that the text that he was uncovering, and it was hard to get text, and much of it is gone, perhaps destroyed, heavily redacted, but what he found, he has used, and that's what the words are.
And what were those texts? There's a whole series of them.
There are letters, diary entries. The mother's biography, Rosemary Kennedy, the mother, she has quite a long biography in which she discusses her husband, Joseph.
Does she discuss the daughter? Because, I mean, famously, the idea was that the Kennedys never mentioned her.
Yeah.
You know, I was killing her off at 23 earlier on, but they barely spoke about her after the age of 23.
Yeah. She in the clips that we see, there is some mention of her. And also, one of the themes comes across very strikingly when she's talking about the dinner table in the Kennedy household and coming to the end of dinner and the men leaning forward to talk, and she felt she could not join the conversation for fear of saying something stupid or that didn't belong in the conversation, and she knew her place.
This is the mother,
you know.
So what we have on, we have an orchestra, is it a 12-piece orchestra or something?
It's very small. It's basically a string quartet with some wind instruments and brass instruments and a lot of percussion.
Right, okay. So we have that music ensemble is there, conducted by Fergus Sheed, also the artistic director of Irish National Opera. And then on stage, we have just three people, one singer, two actors.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. And an unchanging set and a lot of video imagery. And everybody multitasking, particularly the two actors.
Yeah, I'll come back to the set and all of the projections, et cetera, that we see there. But talk to me about it. It's Ronan Leahy and Stephanie Dufresne, who are the actors. So are they speaking parts of these texts from various hospital reports and the like?
That's it, yeah. Hospital reports, intelligence testing, and the neurosurgeon and the neurologist who together brought lobotomy to the United States. We get texts from them.
Mm. And then we have Naomi Louise O'Connell, who's the one singer, so she has quite a task here. Now, is she Rosemary Kennedy, or is she other people as well? Because the actors have to become several different. They're
That's
doctors,
right.
They're politicians, they're all sorts of people.
Yeah. It seems that the creative team didn't really want to confine her to the role. But she dresses the part. She looks, she actually resembles Rosemary Kennedy from the photographs that were shown of her.
I saw a picture of her in the brochure, and she looks like one of the Kennedy family.
Yes.
And even her hairstyle, and it's a red dress that she had in the photograph, I think.
So most
had
of
that
the time.
Feel off it.
Yeah, most of the time. If you're sitting in the audience, most of the time you are thinking, this is Rosemary. And I think it was quite important to Brian Irvine. He speaks about how sensitive she was, and a poetic soul, and beautiful. And so it's fitting that
that Naomi Louise O'Connell
is also beautiful. You know,
and the other thing that she has to do, so she's Rosemary Kennedy in some shape or form, but she also sings some of those texts that we're talking about as well, and one that I want to listen to, which is the Vineland Lab Lecture. What was that?
This is the Vineland Institution was something set up by Henry Goddard, who was a psychologist and believed in the value of eugenics. He didn't quite go so far as believing in compulsory sterilization, but he kind of teeter-tottered between. He did some good things for education for children with intellectual disabilities, but he also went into some terrible cul-de-sacs. And this this text, which is part of the opera, is about that slide we were talking about from intellectual disability and into moral depravity and criminal.
All right, so Naomi Louisa O'Connell, the mezzo-soprano that we're hearing here. Naomi Louisa O'Connell there with a section from a piece called The Vineland Lab Lecture from Least Like the Other, which is the Irish National Opera production at this year's Galway International Festival. Arena, coming to you from the Galway studios this evening, Michael Dungan speaking to us about this particular INO production. That style of music that we're hearing there, the first thing that struck me when I heard it, Michael, was that's a 12-piece orchestra.
Yes.
It sounds like a lot more than that. Is that stridency and that big cacophonous type of sound, does that stay there for the whole opera?
No, it doesn't. It's very expressive. It's very expressive of, I suppose, of the insides of people, perhaps the insides of the characters, but also inside the audience. I mean, the words that she's saying there, many feeble-minded women are very attractive. So we've got to watch out for those good-looking women, because they may be feeble-minded and they may lead us into sexual immorality.
These words, not only are they being spoken, but to get back to this thing that you were talking about, the set and how the piece is actually presented to us.
Yes.
A lot of the words are projected up onto the walls as well around us.
And photographs, family photographs, images of the various doctors and scientists that we hear about. There's a famous occasion where the Kennedys were in London and the women were making their debut, and poor Rosemary had difficulty learning the correct curtsy for court. We see these, we see images of these projected onto the walls of this very kind of clinical, I don't know, it's a laboratory come archive set.
And that balance between them, you know, is very clinical in some aspects. Mm. Are there more lyrical passages, both in music and in terms of the content? Do we begin to feel a sympathy for the character of Rosemary in particular, I guess?
We do. I think the most striking moment in that regard is a small bit of video that suddenly appears after a passing comment, almost, that Rosemary loved dancing and loved swimming. And as I said, as a teacher, you would seize on the things that the kid likes. And here are two things. And next there's this...
Although I'm sure they would have been worried about the morality of the dancing as well, given the sort of attitudes to other things.
But we have this video of a swimming pool, just the surface of a swimming pool, and then a figure... You can't quite make out who it is, but it looks like a 1940s bathing costume going by, and it's slow. And there's repose in the music at that time as well, and everybody takes a breather. And
very effective. Performances then, I suppose, the most important in some ways, Naomi Louisa O'Connell, the lone singer here, the mezzo-soprano. Yeah. She has quite a lot. I mean, even vocally, what she had to do in that clip that we played, it's demanding.
She's amazingly agile. Amazingly agile vocally. It's a demanding score. Plus there's so many other things going on at the same time. It's not stand and deliver and everybody else stand still and
no
listens.
Big aria, here's my big tune.
No, somebody else could be speaking at the same time that she's singing, and there'll be text and images flying by on the walls, but she keeps going.
So the spoken texts then from Stephanie Dufresne and Ronan Leahy, they are happening both with music, with singing sections and by themselves, I presume, as well.
Yeah, and they're brilliant. They do different accents and different American accents, from different parts of America, and different levels of authority and they are stunning.
It sounds as if you, I don't know if enjoyed is quite the right word, but you were certainly very intrigued and stimulated by this opera. Had you any caveats, any kind of question marks around it, Michael?
I should, shouldn't I? But I don't. I was very excited to see that something that, with the reputation of opera, could be so immediate. I've said it to many, many people that I know, you don't have to be an opera buff to be blown away by this. And I think it's a real triumph for Irish National Opera to take a risk on something new like this, to give the world premiere, and to have come up with something that just about anybody could be impressed by.
And be very interesting to see if this is a production that they could take to the United States. I wonder how it would be received there.
That would be very, very interesting.
Yeah, sure would. Well, it's a big thumbs up from you anyway, Michael.
It is indeed, yeah.
Michael Dungan talking to us there about Least Like the Other, Searching for Rosemary Kennedy. It's at the Black Box Theatre. It's on right now, in fact. It started at 7 o'clock this evening, but it's also on tomorrow and Saturday, 7 p.m. And you can find out full information and book tickets on GIAF.ie. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena, coming to you this evening from Galway as the Galway International Arts Festival continues. James Shapiro, author of several acclaimed books on Shakespeare and professor of English at Columbia University, arrives in Galway this weekend to discuss his next book, Shakespeare and a Divided America. He'll be talking to Patrick Lonergan on Saturday as part of the First Thoughts Talk series, which is part of this year's Galway International Arts Festival. James, I was interested to see that, in fact, the engagement with Shakespeare goes right back in American history, right back to the 1770s, when both sides of what was then your War of Independence, those who were pro the British rule and those who were anti-British rule, both of them used Hamlet and his to be or not to be soliloquy as some kind of defence. How did that work?
It's always been a tug of war over Shakespeare in America and in Ireland as well. I'm excited to be speaking with Patrick Lonergan, who's been working on 1916 and the uses of Shakespeare in Ireland. So at pivotal moments in nations' histories, Shakespeare becomes a rope both sides tug at. And in the years leading up to the Revolutionary War in the late 18th century, as America broke from Britain, both sides seized on Shakespeare, claiming him for themselves, using the most famous speeches like Hamlet's to argue for independence or argue for British rule.
And throughout the 19th century and through the 20th century, did that same tug of war continue at very specific points in history?
It did, and usually at the most pressured moments in America's national history. The Civil War is a striking example, and one of the things that has fascinated me is President Abraham Lincoln was as invested in Shakespeare as any American in the 19th century, and he read Shakespeare as a child, carried Shakespeare with him throughout his political career, and during the dark days of the Civil War, turned to Shakespeare again and again, and so did the man who would assassinate him, the actor John Wilkes Booth. So both sides in debates about race, in debates about immigration, empire, whatever the issues are, have tried to grab Shakespeare and enlist him on their side in American history.
I suppose when you see a title like Shakespeare and a Divided America, it's very difficult not to look at today's America and to what extent did the particular situation America finds itself in now, did that feed into the writing of this book?
It did in an important way. I'm a professor of English at Columbia University, but when I'm not lecturing to my students, I'm working at New York's Public Theater, trying to bring free Shakespeare to New Yorkers. And every summer we have two massive productions of Shakespeare in the park, in Central Park. And 50,000 people see it for free. Two summers ago, we worked on a production of Julius Caesar. And in that production, a man who resembled Donald Trump quite extraordinarily played Julius Caesar. And was assassinated on stage. And it riled the mostly liberal audience, but it infuriated the right wing in America, who started sending people to disrupt the production and started sending death threats to the actors and the director of the show. So Shakespeare is not simply something that is read and taught in classrooms. It is and has been weaponized in America for the past 200 years or so.
I suppose, though, it's reasonable to point out that Julius Caesar, and if you say that the actor playing that part resembled President Trump quite a lot, Julius Caesar is assassinated in this play. There must have been anxieties around staging the assassination of an actor, a person, a character who looked like the current president.
Well, there were anxieties about it, but the truth is, one of the things the play teaches us is the conspiracy didn't work. It ended up destroying democracy. So the director of this production, Oscar Eustace, was trying to give a mostly liberal audience a sense of whiplash, realizing that they were witnessing something that coincided with their deepest desires to just get rid of Trump, but at the same time realizing that violence was disastrous as an option. And I think that we are at the point in America today where we are losing the ability to sit down and talk about Shakespeare reasonably, or talk about anything reasonably. The rift between the left and the right has grown so great. And one of the ways for me of measuring that rift is by looking at how each side responds to and appropriates Shakespeare.
You mentioned some of the reactions to the production. I'm wondering how many of those reactions actually happened as the production played out in front of the audience. You know, was there heckling coming from the audience? Did it become quite a ribald debate?
The director, Oscar Eustace, is also the artistic director of the Public Theatre and had resources to make this an extraordinary production. And one of the resources he had was 50 actors planted in the audience. And as soon as Caesar was assassinated, they rose up in ones or twos, scattered through this 1,800-seat outdoor theater, and started screaming at the actors, denouncing what had happened on stage. And no one in the audience, except for those of us who were part of the production, knew that these were plants. Mm. People started getting very, very anxious. But then when real right-wing agitators came into the audience, and there was both, if you will, fake agitators and real agitators, it got even more confused and confusing. And I have to say, I went to the theater night after night watching this with great interest until it became actually so tense that I found myself having to leave the theater because it was standing in the way of my appreciation of what was otherwise an extraordinary production. But because I'm a white man in his 60s, I resembled Trump supporters, so that the security forces thought that I was rushing the stage, and only because friends were working with the security forces, I myself wasn't tackled and dragged off to protect the actors. So I can't communicate how extraordinary a moment it was as Americans in this playhouse were negotiating the very fraught politics of our moment.
Julius Caesar and that play and that production obviously speaking very much to a contemporary moment. Are there specific plays you think that have spoken to American audiences in a different way from perhaps the way they might speak to a European audience over time?
One of the things that distinguishes America from almost any other nation that has engaged Shakespeare is we have shed blood over Shakespeare. When a British actor, MacReady, came to New York and decided to play Macbeth at the Astor Place Theater, there were riots in the street. 15,000 New Yorkers turned out in the mid-19th century to protest a British actor playing Macbeth at this upscale theater. And the militia was called out, and people were fired upon. A score were killed, 100 or so wounded, and it looked like, for a moment, New York would fall into civil war. So what I'm describing, what has happened in that production in 2017 in Central Park, has a long back history of Americans getting riled for one reason or another over Shakespeare. In that case, it was Macbeth. when John Wilkes Booth assassinated Lincoln, he quoted from Julius Caesar in his letter that he wrote before the assassination, justifying what he had committed himself to do. So there are a few plays that time and again tend to galvanize interest in America. And in the 36 or so Shakespeare plays, there's always some issue, political, social, some identity politics that seems to be a source of conflict. Those plays tend to galvanize these responses.
Has Othello been a particularly a play that has given forth productions that came at moments of great consternation?
Probably no play more than Othello has divided Americans. In the South, before the Civil War, it was one of the most popular plays, except it was only performed by white men who had blackened their skin. And after the Civil War, it died out in the South. In America, the first time an African-American actor was allowed to perform Othello on Broadway was not until the Second World War, when in 1943, Paul Robeson took the stage and played that part. Over a century after the African-American actor Ira Aldridge had played Othello on the London stage. So the play is really a bellwether of race relations in America. And every time that play is staged today, you get a sense of what the fault lines are about race, about interracial relations and marriage. It is a radioactive play that's different in America than because we practiced slavery far longer than almost any other nation, Western nation, surely. And one of the ways that I can grapple with things that I don't understand as an American about my country, I can only do through Shakespeare, through watching how audiences respond, how directors imagine these plays today.
Can you tell me a little bit, James, about, you mentioned your work with the Public Theatre, you're a Shakespeare scholar in residence. Tell me a little bit about the 90-minute mobile unit performances, which sound quite astonishing, I must say.
About a half century ago, Joe Papp, who created the Public Theatre, decided Shakespeare belonged to everybody. And one of the things that he created was touring Shakespeare that went from borough to borough in New York to reach audiences that were not upscale audiences. And when it was revived a decade or so ago, one of the decisions was made to take these plays, these 90-minute productions, to prisons and halfway houses and community centers. And one of the great pleasures of my life, although it's been fraught at times, is going into federal penitentiaries or really rough jails like Rikers Island in New York, bringing Shakespeare to these inmates. And it has been a learning experience for me because many of these people who have been incarcerated have a more profound understanding of the issues that are in these plays of violence, family separation, depression, loss, humiliation. Shakespeare really, really is about powerful emotional issues and conflicts, and these people live through them. Taking Macbeth to a prison where there were people who were there for having committed murder and listening to a murderer, Macbeth, reflect upon what he had done and watching audience members react was extraordinary. And I also have to say that unlike modern audiences, these audiences were often impolite. They would shout out, they would scream at actors when the actors were committing actions they thought were wrong. Watching with the women in Rikers Island, the family reunion at the end of Pericles, where father, wife, and daughter are reunited after decades, was wrenching in the extreme. So I think this is a great idea. I think it should have an international appeal. But right now, it's being done in a number of places in the United States, but probably nowhere more effectively than at the Public Theatre.
Just one final question, James. You gave talks and lectures in the Republican states, the red states, places like Alabama, Kentucky, and Texas after the election of President Trump. Did you bring your complete works of Shakespeare with you? Were they discussed? What kind of things did you talk about on those lectures?
You know, it's a funny thing, and I haven't really talked about this, and I don't really write about it, but I'm happy to share a bit. I was down in Alabama, and I was giving two lectures, and the first night was a Wednesday or a Thursday, and there were very few people in the audience, and I was told it's a big night for the mega churches, and you're going to lose your audience. And the next night, it was true. I had a very large audience because I wasn't competing with the preachers. And I was talking about Othello and race and what we call in America the N-word, the word we don't use to describe blacks. And the old, very polite white women in the audience were describing to me the six or seven different ways in which that N-word could be spoken. And for somebody who's a native New Yorker who did not live as they had under segregation, it was illuminating to me. So we live in a country where we don't all speak the same language, but where Shakespeare is a shared legacy and is the one of the very few things that still holds us tentatively together.
James Shapiro there, and James will be discussing his upcoming book, Shakespeare and a Divided America, with Patrick Lonergan at the Aula Maxima in NUI Galway, 5 p.m. this coming Saturday, 20th of July. And welcome back to Thursday Night's Arena, coming to you this evening from our Galway studios. Mary McGill and Ian Walsh are with me now, and they've been very busy since the festival started on Monday, visiting a number of theatre performances and visual arts events. And we'll start with theatre, why don't we? All singing, all dancing, knee-high theatre production, Dead Dog in a Suitcase and other love songs. Mike Shepherd, the director, was on with us on the programme yesterday, and we got a sense that this takes the Beggar's Opera, the John Gay, 18th century opera as its starting point in, but I suppose it's really about 21st century Britain and Brexit. He was very angry, Mike Shepherd, yesterday about Brexit and UKIP and all the things that happened in Cornwall made him want to leave the place. What's it about?
Yeah, so as you said, it is a retelling of the Beggar's Opera. It is a high energy, spectacular kind of total theatre piece, just performed by an amazingly talented ensemble cast of actor musicians. In this Beggar's Opera, if people aren't familiar, I mean, the Beggar's Opera is like the most popular theatre piece of the 18th century, a ballad opera with, you know, popular music of the time that satirises conservative values of its day, and kind of charted the criminal underbelly at that time. And then we had, you know, famously the Threepenny Opera as well with Bertolt Brecht, and Kurt Weill. In those versions, the famous Macheath, which we have, you know, Mac the Knife from, is kind of a libertine character and is kind of celebrated for all his kind of misdemeanors. Whereas here, you know, there's a little bit of joy from a lot of those different things that he's doing. But really, I think it's interrogating this idea of falling in love with sort of beguiling celebrities, more relevant.
Macheath is the celebrity here, is he?
He is a little bit, yeah. And in a way, everyone is in the cast because they're all doing, you know, the most heinous things, but they're having the most fun doing them, and we're enjoying them doing them as well. But by the end of it, he really twists things in that he rewrites the ending from the traditional piece where we realise where all this sort of leads to, and it's definitely a real comment on celebrity politics, Trump, Boris Johnson, all that kind of stuff, you know.
And I was at Mike Shepherd about this yesterday too, Mary McGill, Dead Dog in a Suitcase and other love songs, and I realised they could have said, and everything else, including the kitchen sink, probably could be added on to it. There's a lot at play here. What does the title tell us about it, about the piece?
Yes, well, the title tells us the piece speaks as much to the present as it does to the past, as Ian was saying. The dead dog does feature in the play, but it's also kind of a wink towards a famous internet meme and an urban legend, which is not true, Sean. But if you go online and you Google it, you will find news reports about this infamous dog that was found in the suitcase. So this was a commentary on the world that we live in which the truth always comes with a question mark. What is true, what is not? And in the wonderful play that we saw last night, the last good man, Mayor Goodman, is assassinated and his wife promises to avenge him. And it is through her that that these kind of points are made, you know, very, very distinctly. She says at one point, we all deserve a choice. We all deserve the truth. And she says later on, you can't blame the world. We make the world. And this is exactly the point. You get what you invest in, and you know, you reap what you sow in this idea that we are all, and as much as we like to give out about the state of the world, we are all a part of what we see around us.
The 18th century, the John Gay version, lots of 18th century street ballads. The Brecht version had the Kurt Weill music, which was a kind of a particular almost cabaret style of that period. What sort of music are we getting here, Mary?
Is there anything that we're not getting here? I think we're getting ska, we're getting punk, we're getting dubstep, we're getting grime, we're getting disco. Am I leaving anything out, Ian? We're getting it all. And we're getting it so well. I mean, this is a head-spinning production. We go from deeply dramatic moments to comedic moments to ensemble pieces to solos to mime. It is an absolutely incredible production.
All right, and we also get to, so they're playing the instruments, they're singing, they're dancing, and are they doing the puppeteering as well, or is there one person essentially
one person primarily that's doing a lot of the puppeteering? And that is Tim Daling, who operates the dog, who recurs and kind of is an ever-present thing, both dead and alive on stage. There's an evil monkey, and there's this Punch and Judy show that goes throughout the piece, which has this kind of choric function where it opens the piece, it closes the piece, and they work kind of to foreshadow action that's going to happen, also kind of comment on action that's happening as well. Indeed, kind of Punch sort of stands in some ways for McKeith at times as well. So it's just beautifully integrated into the piece generally. But the thing that was that people delighted in last night when I was there was these baby puppets. So McKeith, with all his philandering, the consequences are a lot of babies. And we have all these baby puppets that arrive on stage. They do a little song and dance number, amongst other things.
And children and animals, they're working with both in this production.
Exactly, and they got their own round of applause, you know, and deservingly so, actually.
They were deeply creepy.
Yeah. Oh, creepy babies, yeah. Now, we might come to different type of babies when we're talking about Sam Jinks later on. Which is one of the visual exhibitions, visual arts exhibitions that you'll be speaking about. But just sticking with knee-high at the moment, Michael Vail designed the set here. So it would seem they have to be actors, singers, dancers and acrobats. It's a very difficult set to negotiate. Was that problematic or was it kind of part of the fun, Ian?
Oh, I loved the set. You know, it's kind of an industrial playground, as the only way I can kind of describe it. It's a series of different platforms that move. But we also have a slide on stage and then we have like a fireman's pole. And it's just an invitation for the actors to play and indeed for us as an audience to play with them.
I think of it that way.
I'd like to think they think of it that way.
They persuaded you that they were having fun.
Oh, very much so. Like there's constant movement going on. The whole thing is kind of a whirly gig, and they have to push, swing, jump, dangle, and slide their way through this show.
Yeah. All right, okay. You both enjoyed this. Any hesitation in recommending it, Ian? First of all,
one of the best things I've seen. To be honest, I would be urging everyone, if you can, go and see this.
All right, and are you in the same boat, Mary? Have you any caveats?
Look, if you like your theatre reserved, then it's probably not for you. If you like quiet plays, if you're against bawdiness, then probably give it a miss. But if you want to go and have your head blown off and feel uplifted and enraged, then I would recommend this very much indeed.
And they've shortened the title, I see, in the programme, in the festival diary in front of me here, Dead Dog in a Suitcase is all they're calling it for ease. Yeah. It's at the Bailey Allen Hall in NUIG in Galway. 6 p.m. tomorrow and Friday, and then two shows on Saturday, 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. And from what Ian and Mary are saying, you certainly want to put that one on your list. You couldn't give a different style of theatre, really, in terms of the second piece that you've both been to see, which is Eugene O'Brien's play, Eden. This is a play, it's been around for a while, obviously. So when did we first get Eugene O'Brien's play and what story was he telling and is he still telling in that play, Mary?
Yeah, 2001 was, I think, the original production of Eden. And I mean, and what we get in this production, I think, is pretty much it as it was. I did find myself wondering, I mean, it's set in the Midlands. We meet this couple, Billy and Breda.
Led by...
played by Patrick Ryan and Leslie Conroy. They are about to celebrate 10 years of marriage. Would you believe it, Sean? The marriage is not going so well. They live in a drink-saturated small town where, you know, everybody's social life revolves around the pub, yet everybody's miserable, yet nobody seems to have joined the connection between the two. So I think, you know, I was struck by how familiar this material is. So there was an element of me wondering, you know, where's the newness in this, shall we say? It's a very competent production. It's a very interesting and moving look at two characters who are very isolated within this community and this marriage.
I remember at the time when the very first production in, there were a lot of monologue plays around at that time. The monologues seemed to be de rigueur in the early noughties. Whereas in the case of Eugene O'Brien's monologue play, it struck me that somehow these two monologues between Billy and Breda, between Billy and Breda, that the two monologues really interlinked in a way that other plays of that time, the monologues weren't as connected. This really is two people who are trying desperately to talk to each other, but they're not meeting at all.
Yeah, and that's foregrounded, I think, like in the form of the piece, in that, you know, we have these two people on stage, two actors who are sharing a stage, but they're not talking to each other, but they are talking to us as an audience, and they can't talk to each other. And in this production, you know, they're very clearly kind of have their places that they're stationed in, you know, one is stage right, one is stage left, and between them, center stage, is a bench, and that bench is a bridge that seems to be, in some ways, there's a longing for them both to share on that bench that is like a bridge between them, but also it's something that's kind of keeping them apart. They never quite get there to actually having a moment where they share a piece of dialogue. It is a monologue pieces that intersect, and we learn through the narrative as it progresses.
But of course, that's reflective of the situation of the couple themselves. In that, Breda is very excited about this night, that potentially they can kind of ignite the passion or the love in their marriage.
Yeah.
And Billy, on the other hand, is busy thinking about young Imelda, one of the young women from another part of the town.
Yeah.
You know, whatever, 10 or 50, 10 years is junior probably.
Yeah, and, you know, the characters can seem perhaps quite historically set or dated in some ways now because, you know, Billy is so kind of boorish and kind of vile in his pursuit of this younger girl.
Yeah, he has never heard of hashtag Me Too.
No, and it seems all the harder to be sympathetic for him, but, you know, fair dues to Patrick Ryan. He manages to make him likable
and
actually sympathetic by the end of the night. And likewise, Breda's character with Leslie Conroy. She is she's a bit of a doormat. You know, she is hopelessly devoted to this horrible man, and you're really frustrated in her performance. You know, like, she's so good at projecting that to us. But that when she begins to rebel and get a little bit of affection for herself, you know, there is that kind of celebration for her. But it's still all tinted with loneliness and isolation, foregrounded in the form of the play that these two isolated figures never speak to
each other. One of the things I think that Eugene O'Brien's play does is it shows you just the simple power of language and straightforward, somebody standing up and telling you a story using great language. And it has great Midlands colour in it in that respect, Mary.
It is, yeah, that they, you know, summed up in the phrase pure Mew, which went, you know, was a TV show.
Which then
show.
Became the TV series. Absolutely, that Eugene O'Brien subsequently wrote, with many of the characters that are mentioned in this play appeared in pure Mew, TV series.
That's it. And it's a real celebration of language and colloquialisms in that sense. But, you know, just to return to the point about masculinity as well, there's something really inherently tragic about Billy, because this display of masculinity is hyped up. A lot of it is bravado. And we learn over the course of the play that he is, in fact, a rather unreliable narrator of his own life. And he's trapped within this masculinity that he, you know, so outwardly, so boorishly, as Ian said, wears. And I found myself with Breda getting frustrated. I wish that she would push back. I wish she would confront him about this. But as we, you know, as we've been saying, the whole play centres around these two people who just cannot connect. You know, there is this metaphorical and literal bridge between them on the stage. But it is it's an interesting piece. I felt towards the end that you know, the resolution is brave in the sense that there isn't necessarily a happy ending. It's a very ambiguous ending, and I enjoyed that because it felt true to the characters.
All right, are you both recommending this, or have you caveats, Mary? First of all,
I think go for it. Yes, I mean, these are great performers. It is an interesting story, and I think as somebody coming from rural Ireland, I certainly recognised it very much.
Yeah, they're all very recognisable
characters. Strong performances, you know, well directed by Andrew Flynn
of Decadent Theatre.
of Decadent Theatre Company in the lack of fussiness. And it's a historical piece, but it shows the ugliness, the excess of the Celtic Tiger, and, you know, maybe a warning for us there not to return to some of these things, and I think worth it for that.
So Eden runs at Nuns Island Theatre, and it's there 8 p.m. Every evening, with matinees some of the days as well on Fridays, it seems to be. 2 p.m. and 8 p.m. and it's at Nuns Island Theatre, GAAF, for details of that. And in fact, everything happened at the theatre festival. Let's move to the visual arts area now, and the big one again from where we were yesterday, Mary. This was In the Flesh, the Sam Hicks exhibition in the Festival Gallery. I want to play the reactions of some of the people who were at it, but to do that, first of all, will you set up what exactly we see in the Sam Jinx exhibition?
So when you go into the new Festival Gallery, which is a wonderful space off William Street here in the middle of Galway, you see sculptures, John, that are so lifelike, your body begins to react. So the first ones I saw were called babies. These are tiny, they look like newborn babies. And you find yourself growing quiet because you don't want to wake the babies. The babies look so real, right? They've got the curvature of the feet and the spine and their hair, but they're not real. They're not real at all. And so when I was there on Monday morning, just after the gallery opened, and all I could hear around me was, wow, wow, wow.
Okay, well, let's hear some of the wows, because I think there's quite a lot of wows in terms of how... The people who had been in, I think mostly either on Monday morning and yesterday morning, speaking to our reporter Sinead Egan here, up to 2,000 visitors a day visiting the Festival Gallery, and here's the reaction of just some of them to the Sam Jinx exhibition.
Yeah, they were absolutely amazing. They were practically scary, since they're so lifelike. The fact they all had their eyes closed is the telling part of... You had to look at yourself to see what was there. They were... soul searching.
Really?
Yes, they really were. They were beautiful.
I was just going to say, how did you feel when you were standing close to them?
Vulnerable. Because they show the vulnerability of the human being.
It's very emotional and just so tender and just so intimate. I truly enjoyed it. If you can, in a way that is so spiritual. Each one of them had some meaning for me. Either personally or through a friend. So it evoked a lot of emotion for me.
It was hard to remember at points that they are sculptures. It was incredibly vivid and incredibly lifelike. So like a fetus, to see two babies and to see the progression of age and the cycle of life, essentially, was insane. Like I was privy to something that I shouldn't be. Yeah, it felt... I had to remind myself that they were sculptures and not real people.
I really felt empathy for the man holding what looked like his older father. So it was a bit heart-wrenching, actually, a bit sad. But yeah, it was amazing.
Purely authentic. You think the people are actually sat there, like, you know? Absolutely brilliant.
Can you describe to me what you saw?
Oh, I saw the lady and the babies there as well, like, you know, they just... You think they were after coming over their mammy's womb, like, you know?
I love the materials that he's used and the fact that he's incorporated real hair and real clothing. I think there's just this feeling of intimacy and connection with other human beings.
It's quite an emotional exhibition, you know, but very touching. You're just waiting for him to get up and walk around. It's fantastic, you know. So, yeah, I'm really pleased I came to see. I wasn't quite sure whether to come down or not, but, yeah, I've enjoyed it. But it is brings up quite a lot of emotion, though.
Why is that?
I think having touched different forms of grief in my life just reminded me of connections, maybe with my grandfather, and also I lost two young children, so that sort of touch... That touches me as well. But it's very nice to come here and see. It's almost like a sense of peace from seeing that.
Yeah. Can I ask, when you're standing close to these sculptures, how does it make you feel?
For me, there was a sense of connection maybe with the divine in some way, like a spiritual experience. It's very special.
And And there are the voices of some of those who visited Sam Jinks's exhibition In the Flesh at the Festival Gallery. Ian Walsh and Mary McGill still with me. They've been to see the exhibition as well. Extraordinary kind of responses there, Ian. Emotional was the big one. Mm. Everybody talking about how vivid and how lifelike these things were. Mary mentioned the two little babies. Maybe you just explain some of the other exhibits that we see and how lifelike they are.
Yeah, so they actually take sort of classic sculpture poses and, and setups. You know, we have woman with child. We have the Pieta almost represented. We have a Medusa.
Yeah, the Pieta that one of the women there mentioned about the middle aged man perhaps holding his older father. That's the Pieta, the Pieta style one. Whereas the woman with child, I think, yeah, well, that's a different one over there.
Yeah, but I mean, it's woman with child, but it is actually an older woman with a baby. He's really interested in these polarities, and the word kind of vulnerable came up there a few times.
Yeah,
he's interested in, you know, challenging what sculpture is. It's these art sculptures aren't about vital, dynamic bodies. They aren't about commemorative memorials to people. It's about actually, like it says, the flesh. And the flesh is transient. The flesh is something that's not permanent, that's changing. All the figures here, the middle-aged man, etc., has thinning hair. There's detail where the nails are, you know, almost growing in front of you. You know, they're longer. So it challenges that form.
And yet, you know, so we have those very real exhibits in one of them, but in the main room of the exhibit space, in this kind of an ante room, little room off, there's this phenomenal big angel.
Yes.
a female figure.
Yes.
Looking as if she's about to take off.
Absolutely. She's called Iris, which is very fitting because there's something of Icarus about her as well, I feel. She's these enormous, beautiful golden wings. And what I found interesting about going to see Iris after seeing, you know, the babies and the Pieta style still life, it's called, was that she is very different. She's very distinctive compared to those pieces.
Yeah.
But in her presence, you can hear the hum of people in the main part of the gallery as they go around and say their wows. But when they are confronted by Iris, they go silent. And I was standing amongst people and they were just standing there looking at her, barely even taking out their phones, although there was a few phones.
Yeah, didn't see too many phones.
Yes,
that's unusual.
Yes, she is truly a spectacle. And I think what's very interesting and comes across in those vox pops as well, there's something spiritual almost about this exhibition.
Yeah, because what worried me was I thought, oh, this is going to be all very lifelike and it's going to be like Madame Tussauds Wax Museum. Mm. And it couldn't be, even though it looks like a perfect wax model, it's far more lifelike than any wax model I've ever seen.
Mm. Yeah, and they're not to scale. Like they aren't the pieces aren't the same size as your average human. You know, they are less than that.
And they're on pedestals.
And they're on pedestals.
Gives a kind of an artistic component.
Gives a slight distance to it. But the way that it's organized is almost like that person said, the cycle of life. We begin with actually the one piece that's an oversized fetus at the beginning as we enter the space, and then by the end the depictions of middle age, old age, newborns, vulnerable ages, and then we move to this messenger at the end, or angel, which perhaps is death or the mythic beyond, something we can't kind of materialize.
So a lot
so seems
more,
to bring
lot,
us through the whole cycle.
A lot more emotions came to both of you clearly watching this than perhaps you might have expected on the surface.
Yes, I was talking to a volunteer on the day. She said she already had one woman cry. Yeah. This is Monday morning. And I will say what was glorious about it was it just shows the power of art, Sean. You know, this is attracting a really, really wide demographic. Young people, old people, we heard it there in the Vox Pops. It's wonderful to have this space.
All right, that's In the Flesh. Sam Jinks is at the Festival Gallery, which is the kind of pop-up space that the gallery has every year. And that's running until the 20th of July. The ones that you went to separately, giving out to you for not going together. Waiting room, first of all. It's hard to say what waiting room is out in the O'Donoghue, what's it, the O'Donoghue space out in NUAG.
My own workplace, yes, yeah. The O'Donoghue Centre, yeah.
You could call this Enda Walsh piece a piece of theatre, you could call it a visual art, you could call it an installation. What do you call it, Ian?
It's
the easy question first.
It's a bit of all of those things, to be the political about it almost. To me, it's a theatre piece, actually, because it's all about presence and experience and being in the space, actually, and I think theatre is based
around space.
And what space
are we in?
We're in a waiting room, as the title would suggest, although we're first escorted in. It's a small room. There's only, you know, kind of maximum about sort of six people that are allowed in at a time. There's only two people when I went in. You go in and you're in a small corridor, and then we go into this waiting room. And inside there, then we sit down, and it's very realistically done out. And then the lights go down, and then a voiceover begins with Aoife Duffin telling us this story of this woman, and she narrates in the first person about herself. Yeah,
And self, and a big event in her life that we don't want to say what it is. It's 15 minutes long, so we let people discover that for themselves. This is one of a series. You've seen all of the series, I think.
I actually have, yeah.
Rooms from Enda Walsh.
I've been privileged enough to see all the different rooms, and I think they work on different themes each time. And it's lovely to see them collectively build, and it's a real feature of the festival, I think, that people keep coming back to see every year. This one, for me, though, I have to say, one of the more moving ones, I thought.
All right. This one worth seeing. I just want to give the final 30 seconds to Mary, and Placing Home, Hidden Stories from Sarah Hickson. She had a big exhibition, a part of last year's festival, picking up on the whole theme of refugees and what is home.
Absolutely. So last year, I was really struck by her work as part of the festival gallery. It looked at the jungle in Calais and how people had created homes in this absolutely chaotic space. She is working on a photographic project looking at residents of direct provision here in Galway, and that's going to be fully exhibited next year as part of the festival. But also in the O'Donoghue Centre, this is just a really, really interesting look. Sarah has travelled all over the world photographing refugees.
Is it essentially, do you think this is documentary or photojournalism, or is it something more than that? Not that that's a lesser thing.
Do you know what it is, Sean? It is photojournalism, but in the current moment, given the crises that we have around home, whether it's in an Irish context or in an international context, we have the highest number of refugees on the move since the Second World War. The issue of home is, in and of itself, is so politicised and so timely that these photographs, by their very nature, are simply photographs in one respect, but they are also so much more than that.
All right, that's Placing Home, Hidden Stories by Sarah Hickson, and indeed the Waiting Room piece that we were speaking about, both at the O'Donoghue Centre and NUIG in Galway. Mary McGill and Ian Walsh reviewing all of those things for us this evening. Lots to do, clearly, at the Galway International Arts Festival, which runs right through until Sunday the 28th of July. That's our lot from Galway. Elaine Connell was the broadcast coordinator. Paula Shields was the researcher this evening. John Doyle and all in the Galway studios, thanks to them. John was on sound this evening, and thanks to him and all in the Galway studios. Tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. John Creedon is next.